Well, it's a pleasure to welcome you here today. We have today Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google. Eric's a bachelor's from Princeton, a PhD from Berkeley, been through a huge number of companies, Xerox PARC, Sun, where he was CTO, Novell, now Google. I asked him how come he'd been so many jobs in the past few years, and I'd only had one. He said, because I have tenure, so I guess that's the answer. Anyway, we should have a great hour. Eric, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. I have wanted to come here for some time to thank you for the quality of your product, which is the students we have been able to bring into Google. We have at least 40, 45 undergraduate and then 15, 20 PhDs already, and we're working on making sure we get the very best and the brightest, and this is one of the three or four universities where we find it. So My first and foremost message is thank you, and we'll take your siblings, your children. We have a long-term view of this issue. We know where you are. What I wanted to do is give you a little sense of Google, talk a little about the company, and I'm really interested in your questions. We've been rushing around, so my talk and my slides may not be quite together. So I sort of have my talk and my slides, and we'll sort of see what happens. The company is, I think everybody sort of knows what we do, and each wave of technology creates a set of companies that become iconic with that phase of technology. Everybody knows about IBM and mainframes and so forth and so on, and of course the mainframe really solved the data processing problem for corporations. Everybody knows about Intel and Microsoft and the enormous contribution they've made to the personal computer and powering individuals. And then there's the Internet. And I had thought that the story about the Internet was really a story about the plumbing, because I'm a plumber, right? Net browsers and operating systems and the what the routers do and fast switching networks and all these sort of interesting things. But in fact, the story of Google is about what you can build on top of it. Right, the story of the Internet highway system is not the roads, but McDonald's and Holiday Inns and so forth. It's the same principle. And so there's this new set of companies, Amazon being, I think, the iconic one here. eBay is another, Yahoo's a third, Google, which I think have come to represent this next wave. And what is characteristic of this wave is how big it is. And each of these waves is much bigger than the previous one. So what happens is everybody says, well, Google's, this or that, and they don't understand that we're operating at a much bigger stage than, for example, the PC industry. The PC industry is a subset of the information industry, just as the PC industry ultimately came to be much larger than the data processing and mainframe industry that presupposed it. So from your perspective, you're playing on a much bigger stage with much bigger stakes. That's why doing what you do now is so very, very interesting. These are pictures of our two founders. I was telling Ed that I've managed professional research labs for 25 years, and I still can't beat an assistant professor and two graduate students. What is it about the graduate students and the assistant professors working late at night that has produced virtually every significant technological innovation, whereas I, with all my resources and all my background in computer scientists, can't compete with that? Right. It's to the credit of the higher education system and to the kind of dedication that's represented in this room. Larry and Sergey clearly did not take the hardware courses at Stanford. This is the first disk storage system that Google used. I'll show you some more pictures. And I want you to know that this is the first Google cluster. This is a Sun and a bunch of PCs and I think an SGI machine. Anyone know what algorithm was used to select the hardware procurement for Google? Price. Yeah. Price. Right. The PCs were free. In fact, everything here was free. This is how graduate school works, right? Now, this is the first rack that was built. And folks here you all are hardware engineers, right? Has anyone studied what happens when you put the disk drive directly on top of the CPU fan? Okay, now you think I'm kidding? Do you see the disk drive? Do you see the CPU? Okay, so after the fire, we learned to... And I'm not making that up. And in fact, the software people who designed this, because clearly they did not have any hardware engineering friends, concluded that the way to provide thermal isolation was to put corkboard Right. So these are, in fact, known as corkboard systems. This particular machine is in the Computer History Museum where you can see it. Now, our users are everywhere. And what's neat about this is that this is a picture of where Google's users are. If you take a picture from the space shuttle, you know, one of those time-lapse pictures of the 90 minutes maneuver, and you see lights, it's the same picture. So in my lifetime, in our career, what I am most proud of is to get the Internet to the same level of penetration as electricity, which also answers the question, why don't you have a lot more queries from the middle of South America? Because it's a rainforest and there's no electrical power, right? So if you want to work on the problem of Internet penetration, work on the problem of getting them electrical power to run their computer devices and their BlackBerries and so forth and so on in the rainforest. Right? So those of us who worked on making the Internet happen spent all this time worrying about, you know, getting all these countries online. They're ready. They just need some power, and they need some inexpensive devices. And, in fact, there are some wonderful people now working on these from a research perspective and getting them economically effective and so forth. And what's neat about this is it says that Google is about what goes on in the world, not just in the United States. A very small minority of our queries are now from the U.S., something around a third of our queries are French, German, English, excluding English, French, German, Italian, Spanish, you know, sort of non-English languages. So the Internet, while we were busy, right, doing what we do here in computer science, ended up really being a very global phenomenon. And eventually, of course, it'll be mostly Chinese. Just do the math. We're all scientists, right? Now, Raymond gave me the wrong slides. Well, this is what happens when you become a public company and you don't pay attention to the rules. So, now, if you go, I'm a little worried about Raymond. I know this is a university audience, but these are actually scientists. What is the most common query on Google? Britney Spears. Anybody know who she is? I did not. Okay. Why is she? Hey, look, I'm proud of who I am. And so why is the Britney Spears so interesting? Because nobody can spell this poor, unfortunate woman's name, who's apparently very famous. And in fact, there are something like 490 different ways of spelling her name. So this very young gentleman, who must have known who she was, invented our spelling corrector. And the way the spelling corrector works is it looks at basically language pairs. It doesn't use a dictionary. So it works in the 105 languages that Google supports. How it works, it's been explained to me. I don't understand it. Maybe some of you will figure it out. But they do some very complicated math to produce the correct spelling for Britney Spears. Now, this, of course, is what would happen if Sergey... I can't believe you did this. This is what would happen if Sergey, one of our founders, was searching in Brittany and Brittany and Brittany and Brittany and so forth. But anyway, we'll keep going. Now, what is the most important thing in this data center? The fan. What is the defining problem at Google? Heat. What produces heat? Personal computers. Why do we have so many of them? Because we need to tighten our software algorithms. No, just kidding. We're going to spend, I don't know, $500 million building computers, some big number next year. It's a public number. I'll show you some pictures of what we're building, but an easy way to think about it is we really are building supercomputers, and we're building them out of commonly available parts. So in a technical audience, we'll talk a little bit about these supercomputers are really loosely coupled supercomputers with PCs, lots of DRAM, lots of disk, and very complicated algorithms for scheduling and job allocation, all running Linux. Now, Linux, it doesn't really use Linux that much. It boots up on Linux, and then our own code runs on it. So those of you who are working in the area of distributed computing, distributed systems, matrix addressing, and so forth, can fairly quickly figure out how you would build a system that needs to, within 0.05 of a second, or 0.005 of a second, or 0.0005 of a second, be able to get to a randomly addressable data object that you can then display to the poor, unsuspecting person who wants to know about Britney Spears. So the basic problem here is we have a power problem, and it's an electrical power problem. Where do you think our data centers are? places with cheap electricity. Going back to the electricity theme. This is an accident. But our racks look like this. Those are just shoes. We did put that in for fun. And the racks are basically CPUs that go in. And, of course, we build them ourselves because at Google we build everything ourselves. We would build the building ourselves if we could find the land. And we would do it with employee labor. You know, I said, don't you think someone could build hardware for us? And people go, no. Never occurred to anyone that the gazillion of server manufacturers might make computers that were fast enough for us. So I said, why don't you try it? So we benchmarked ours. Ours were faster. They won. I lost. So we build our own. Now we build an enormous number. Oh, no. This would be what happened if Larry and Sergey had been... Oh, my goodness. Well, we'll just skip that one. So here we go. Lots of interesting products. This is our satellite maps. Now, a team that we worked with in Australia that are now Google employees did a very interesting thing. They built a map that's on top of a browser. The map's computed on the server, and it uses XML, HTTP, and a number of other JavaScript hacks to basically give you a map that you can drag and drop and move through the space. Very interesting technically. They overlaid it with a set of data that we licensed in the U.S. They didn't bother to do it in Australia for some reason. I guess that's where they live, and they knew where they were. We've since remedied that. And the map is different. There had not been a new mapping construct, as best I could tell, of this type in 5-10 years. How did this happen? Well, three people thought this was interesting. Why are they in Australia? Interesting. Turns out the guy's girlfriend can't get into America because of the stupid visa policies. Think about it. All right. So we're perfectly happy to have these people in Sydney, Australia, where they do U.S. maps and now UK maps. So then the satellite team said, well, why don't we just overlay this with a satellite? So we took our keyhole servers, put them together, and started overlaying the satellite maps. The day this came out, it nearly took Google down because the computation of the satellites and the bandwidth required to ship them throughout nearly killed our internal networks, which are designed for performance and speed. And we actually had what we call code yellows, and all the pagers went off, and everyone went around, and eventually we shaped the traffic just right. And I just signed another $10 million to buy a full wavelength. I want to choose the color. In the WDM architecture, which colors do I get? Do I get red or pink or yellow? I want to be able to say I own a color around the world. You can pick a random color. I mean, it's okay. But I was talking to one of the engineers who said, yeah, we do about 60 gigabits on this particular. I said, do you have any idea how big 60 gigabits is? And they go, yeah, no sweat. So when we talk about scale, think about the millions of people who do this stuff interactively all the time. And that's why you design for performance. Same thing for local search. Local search is likely to be larger than national or international search because you live your things. Of course, this is on a phone. The next generation of devices are all going to be portable. What would happen if you left town for a few days without your cell phone? Life would be pretty difficult. If you're going to leave town with one device, you're going to take your phone. It's going to be your cell phone. It has become, in the last 5 years, something that you literally don't leave one room for the house the other without. Many people are now getting rid of their landlines. I mean, that's how profound this is, especially outside the United States. This is a photo sharing. Same problem. These digital cameras are amazingly popular. They're generating all these different photos. How do you organize them? How do you search them? The technology is very, very primitive. Again, a perfect opportunity for Google to solve a problem. Oh, no. Well, we had fun. We went public. And we try to ignore this. We basically structured the company to run at this scale and solve the problems that we did. This, of course, was two brilliant web search scientists now searching for work. The brand is interesting because it has come to represent trust and scale. People are willing to give us information. Hence, off we go. This is another example of the maps. This is a local search, and you'll see here on the right. It searches for interesting information, directions, and so forth and so on. Now, one of the obvious questions is, how do you make money at this? Well, people live in a local world, and they often do commerce locally. They go to the movies, they buy pizza, and so forth and so on. if we can get the traffic, if we can get people looking for information, we can make money at it. And of course, we had lots of fun. This is an uploading of video. We decided to let people submit video so we would search it. But we haven't displayed it yet because we wanted to look at it. What do you think the percentage of porn is? Anyone want to guess? 85? That's the consensus. About 10%. Of the remaining 90%, what do you think would be considered of a quality that would be minimally acceptable to a human being in just visual quality? It turns out it's maybe 10 or 20%. There's the fellow who sent us a video of just himself typing. Okay. Not even his mother would watch this video. So we're working on this. So just because you give them the tools does not turn them into movie producers. We're going to make those videos available. We will figure out a way to deal with the porn and copyright issues over time and make that available. So you sit there and you wonder, why do we need more data centers? Because of all of your videos, because of all of your photos, right? Because when we say all, we really mean all. And this problem is a big problem. It's a problem a lot of people are going to care a lot about. Uh-oh, this is the international screen. Our business is even stronger outside the United States as people are coming online. And what's funny is that often, for example, in Europe is in trouble economically as sort of a society, but the adoption rate of the Internet is so strong. This is an example of search history. This one is very interesting. If you are willing to let us track your searches, we can provide better quality search history. We can actually target the searches better. So we've had a long debate, and I'm sure people are concerned about this, and we concluded that we would let you decide. Right? The principle is the end user decides. So people can choose to use this, or they can choose not. Sort of makes sense to us. Let's let people decide with information as to how to deal with this. And you can imagine the information that we analyze can be used to do much more targeted searches. Because the world turns out to be very, very disaggregated, right? Lots of people doing lots and lots of different things. But an individual person's interests tend to be fairly narrow, right? They tend to go to the five projects that they're interested in. Their hobbies are pretty much the same every day. But if I take all of your hobbies, it's a very, very long list. So our systems are designed to both know who you are and also provide very targeted results. But we also have to deal with the fact that there's such variation, especially across cultures, languages, and across the world as a whole. We've been experimenting with this personalization. This is something we announced last week, which caused quite a stir. It's basically Google with a personalized bottom. We need to come up with a better name than that, I guess. But you can basically target each of these things. And what's interesting about this is it's all done in JavaScript. And you can basically drag and drop all of the components and configure them. And it's done. In order to do this, you have to log in. Now, today, most of you have never logged into Google, which is fine with us. We're not going to replace it or anything. But the important thing is it's another step toward this personalization of the company, of Google as a whole, from an end-user perspective. So what happens is you say personalize, and then you can click on these things. And these are the initial ones. We're, in fact, putting in a generalized RSS feeder. So you'll be able to scribble. Everybody's saying, yeah, it's kind of the obvious thing, right? It's the obvious thing. We do the obvious things, too. It's kind of obvious, right, to let you basically my random RSS feed, click here, and number two and number three, and then you all of a sudden now you have a dynamic personalized home page that you care about. And I think everybody understands the evolution of RSS and the other push-type technologies will enable this to be a very rich bucket. And eventually it'll be possible to deal with things involving video and moving images and things like that. In any case, we're very concerned that our programmers be very productive. And the single most important thing programmers need is a washing machine and a dryer. So we take this very seriously. This is a picture of one of our many, many laundry rooms. I'm not sure what else to say about that. We have lots of interesting visitors who come by. Again, this is the benefit of being a place that people see online and they want to come see it in person. And it's just as interesting in person, I think. We're also focused on food. You basically cannot move more than about 50 feet without encountering food, which is something I noticed that you did here, which is very good. We're trying to build workplaces that are sort of lifestyle places. And in modern corporate America, there are relatively few such places. This turns out to be one of them, and it works. Right? It builds the kind of teamwork and culture that you really care. We take a ski trip. The whole company goes skiing for 2 days. We try to minimize the number of accidents, that kind of thing. Our two founders, basically, at their 30th birthday party, I took this picture. Anyway, we had a lot of fun with our IPO. We'll skip that one. And this is, at the time, the entire company in the hot tub. It's a very dog-friendly advice. Our dog policy is longer than our human policy and our employee handbook. And it has to do with the output of the dogs and all the rules associated with that. So we do have rules. They apply to the dogs. We run the company, and I'll finish up. We run the company with a rule which we call 70-20-10. 70% on core search and ads, 20% on adjacent businesses, and 10% on other. And employees are encouraged to spend 20% of the time on whatever they want to. And because of the nature of the technical community that we hire from, they do amazing things. And virtually all of the really interesting new things have come out of 20% time. So I'll be sitting in a review, and somebody will say, well, you know, there'll be some very interesting idea, not something I'd ever heard of before, but very, very clever. And I'll say, well, how many people are working on that? And they'll go, oh, you know, 0.6. And I go, is that three 20% times, or is that one person 40% time? You know, you'll have that kind of conversation. And then eventually, if you like it a lot, you try to convince the person who just come up with this idea to spend all their time on it. And usually that's not too hard because they like it and they're excited about it, and they recruit their friends. We call the production of this the production of Googlets. All right, little. Think of them as little groups that are focused on something new. And then over time, those things mature and they become part of Google. And so you go from 10% to 20% to 70%. And we measure this. Of course, everything's done very analytically at Google. So it's possible, even at our current scale, to build an environment which has this kind of scalable architecture, not unlike what we talk about in computer science. And our goal is to do this at every conceivable scale that we need to. And so far, it's worked very, very well. So, and obviously, Google is, as I mentioned, a very proud home for many of your partners, and we're happy to have more really smart people who want to work on these kinds of problems. With that, maybe I could ask for people's comments or questions on anything. Yes, Ed.
So I'm interested in the average amount of time that an engineer spends on a project and whether that's been increasing with time.
It has been increasing on time, and it is. The original design was three people, basically what we call a UTL, which is an Uber team leader. I don't know quite why they're called Ubers, but they're Uber team leader. And then two schlepper types, that's my term. And basically, they form these little groups, and they move very, very fast. Nowadays, the projects have grown to four or five, so they still have a UTL. They often will have a user interface designer or one of the operations people. So many of these problems are done at scale now. We try at Google to work on problems that are new, that affect a lot of people, and they're problems at scale. So we try to avoid doing problems that have already been solved. And there are lots of problems that have not been solved, and that's why we have to design it that way. So I think it is increasing. We've worked very hard to keep it small. You just don't get productivity out of large groups. The length of time, the original design center was 3 to 4 months. It's on the order of 4 to 5 months now. But we've been able to hold it, even with the current scale. And it requires a lot of writing of architectures and training, et cetera.
How long typically will someone spend on a 20% project? Does it last 3 months or a year or 2 years?
They're allowed to do it for as long as they want, but usually what happens is there's enough peer pressure and people are interested in what you're working on that if it really is not working or if you're just sort of in your own space and kind of wacko, there's enough interaction that it sort of gets corrected. It's not managed by anyone. But because we work together so closely, people know what people are working on. Everybody wants to talk about something interesting, not unlike graduate school. I mean, frankly, it's easy to talk to this audience. This model was built out of our experiences as computer scientists in graduate school. So it should feel the same. When I first came in, we had an employee living at Google. And I said, look, I know the place feels like school, but you know, you can't live here. It's against the law. You know, so he took his futon, you know, and he found a friend and he moved in. You can live, you know, you can use the showers, you can brush your teeth, you can eat. Your friends are all here. Your computers are all here, but you got to sleep somewhere else. I don't know if you have that rule here.
We had one student who spent the better part of a year living on the roof of our old building.
Yeah.
And he would actually spelunk down in the morning.
My roommate at Berkeley, when I was a graduate student, lived in our office. My office mate, excuse me, lived in our office. And this went on for 9 months. And after this fourth or fifth month, I just moved out. It just was a bad situation. More comments. Yes, sir, over here.
Do you think of as your competition? There's more competition in the various areas you're in.
It's a very big space. Today we compete with Yahoo every day, and I assume you're referring to for search and for advertising as opposed to for labor. And Microsoft has announced their entry in the market, although they're not a significant competitor yet, although I'm sure they'll try. The space is very, very large, because remember the space is defined as not just web search, but searching everything, so all of the information, you know, movies, books, radio, television, everything printed, everything written, all the journals, all the stuff that's proprietary that you can't get to today. And each of the companies has a different tack on it. Yahoo is busy cross-integrating across relatively proprietary content networks that they're busy buying, which sort of makes sense if you have sort of a studio model, which I think is working pretty well for them. Google is a pure search, pure scale play, right? So we don't do our own content. Microsoft has publicly announced that what they're going to do is embed search in every single bit that there is on a PC screen, as best I can tell. So that's going to be their entry, but of course it'll be some number of months or years, depending on what schedules you assume. So, and my guess is that those will be the big three players, and then there'll be lots of interesting little companies. For those of you who are interested in truly founding companies or are really want to be entrepreneurs, the broadly defined search space is very, very rich with opportunities for small companies as well. So I think we'll see lots of interesting competitors. Yes, ma'am.
I'm interested in how successful it is when you let people do whatever they want. So can you quantify that in any way? Like what percentage of these Google X have become products that we might have heard of or not? Or any metric that you can think of that will give us a feel for?
How do you quantify those? How do you quantify the success? The simplest way to explain it is that our rate of innovation is significantly faster than anyone in the industry and significantly faster than our competitors. We're very proud of that. Yeah. So the obvious players, but a whole bunch more. So we know the answer, independent of the exact math. We do track project lifetimes, but there's so much of a statistical bias there. You know, did you really start it? Did it end it? Did you dismorph it? You can't come up with a truly quantifiable answer to your question. The secret here is not in the way we manage it, which we're very proud of, but in our selection of the people. This model works when you have the right people. It would be a complete failure in an organization that absolutely had to be told exactly what to do and wanted to work on one big project. Right.
That has come out of this.
Well, sort of everything.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, we've run the company since I've been in the company. Excuse me?
The 20% part?
Yeah. Essentially all of the interesting things that you see. So a typical example would be Frugal, which is the product search. We've been looking at this for about a year. People had been thinking about this area, and we kept seeing demos. And then one particular engineer said, I can't take it anymore, and he just built it. Over a few weekends, and presented it, and we said, you know, oh my God, that's it. The personalized search, the homepage that I just showed you, same process. We've been talking about it for a while. Google News, a single researcher, invented a mathematical concept which he is related to a toroid in a way that I never understood. Where he basically looks at all, you know, because our news product reads all the newspapers at once and then figures out which ones are important. So he reads all of the newspapers every so many minutes, and he constructs a mathematical structure that he invented, which apparently everybody, all the mathematicians thought was the neatest thing they'd seen since, you know, so-and-so, you know, the four-color problem or something. And he just applied it, and he did it in his spare time, and that, of course, created a huge business for us. So we wait for these things. I have a number of things that I'm waiting for. Maybe you guys could help me. The product I want is the one where, when I'm typing, it tells me what I should be saying. Right? That would be a huge improvement, not just for me, but for everybody in the world. And we're not quite there yet, so if you could work on that, that would be good. Yes, in the back there.
You mentioned Froogle, and I'm just wondering if you could say a few more words about product search. So you didn't list Amazon as one of your competitors, but should Amazon view you as their biggest competitor?
Amazon has a product called A9, which is a very interesting vertical product search product, which they're doing out of their Palo Alto operations. They're a very, very large advertising partner and customer of ours as well. So again, I would encourage you, when you ask the question about competition, put it into the framework of this very large and evolving space. So if people are going to live their lives online, there will be many such players, and we're all going to work together and compete to some degree. In Amazon's case, we drive a great deal of traffic to them because people come to Google, they see something, they go to Amazon, and we have very good relationships. Jeff was also an early investor in Google. On a personal basis. Yes, sir.
Your keyboard product, when it came out, was kind of interesting, but it was priced a cheap version and an expensive one, and then you all of a sudden brought satellites onto your regular maps, which is really cool. I was just kind of curious what your direction is there, because you had a lot of people want to pay the high-level price for that, or are you going to merge it all into the free version for everybody, or what?
We use price to control demand, right? So if we have too much demand, we have a price that keeps the demand within our manageability. Keyhole, when we acquired them, and it's a very successful acquisition for us, had a two-tier product line, which is the one you're referring to, the $500 product and a $30. These are per year, so these are not hugely expensive. And as we figure out other ways to make money, we'll certainly work on lowering. I mean, our goal is basically to have information access be as free as possible. So we'll look at all of those. But we have product after product where when we bring them out, we have to limit their use. Gmail, for example, is by invitation only. Now, you may think that that's because we want to create a viral marketing effect, and that's a wonderful story. And the real issue is we need to control load. Right, literally, because the people who use Gmail just live on it, and so we look at network capacity, computer capacity, and scale it appropriately. So you should expect virtually all of these things, prices will fall, and they may or may not go to zero. But I mean, it makes perfect sense for us to try to have better. One of the rules about this play is that if you can get the users, you can figure out a way to make money from them later. We used to call this URL, you know, ubiquity first, revenue later. It's the same idea. In the back, yeah.
All right. One of the things that probably struck me as interesting is like the Google research where people pay for research answers to their specific questions. Always seemed like the prices were low enough that who could you pay to do that much research for that little amount of money?
I can't think of a better ad for us. It turns out that there are enough people paying these small amounts of money that we support an ecosystem of, I don't know, somewhere on the order of 1,000 researchers who actually answer the questions for you, and they have little businesses. It's a wonderful thing. If the numbers are big enough, it works. Yes.
Yeah, very much.
And we think that's better because it creates competition. Yeah, and you get some expert in something that I would never think of, and all of a sudden now they are the expert on this, and you know these questions get routed to them, and they literally, it's good for them, their ego, their sense of worth, and they really do provide a great service. Yes, sir, over here.
You mentioned the search history earlier.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll get to the point where you're showing different search results to different people depending on their history, depending on their behavior?
I'm sure we will. It makes sense, right, that to the degree that you're willing to give us more information about you, we can target your searches better. You already give us a little bit by telling us your language, right? That would be a simple version of this, but it will obviously scale. And we have to be sensitive to people's privacy on that. Go ahead, you had a question.
Do you have any plans to expand into the desktop beyond the Google toolbar?
The question is expansion to the desktop. Well, today we have desktop search, And we just announced a product which is Enterprise Desktop Search. So you install this enterprise server in your network as a corporation behind a firewall. And then on your Google homepage, you see my local hard drive and my enterprise as well as the web. So we like that model, the different tiers of information. So the desktop search product is very broad. It's supposed to search everything. People can elect to download it or not. Some people want to find out everything going on their computers, and other people don't. And we're adding all sorts of features around, you know, login to it and security and all that. So basically focused right now desktop on personal desktop search and then integrating that with the whole Google experience. You can imagine taking that and the personalized Google and the search history, and you can imagine all the different products we can make out of that.
Yeah, lots of people criticize Google's business model and most of its profitability and how the stocks were priced. Like, what's your take on this?
I'm a shareholder. let's repeat that. People criticize what again? Do it in order.
The business model?
Why?
Like, they don't know how you guys generate money and, like, all this money, the current model cannot project. We can see how much you can make based on like the stock price it is now.
Okay, so remember the picture of me and Time Magazine? It's probably a mistake for me to talk about the stock price because I get in trouble as this public company CEO and there's all sorts of laws. So let me answer a different question, which is, people would like to see more information about how Google's financials work internally. I'm not talking about Sarbanes-Oxley. I'm talking about how do we make money? What is the formula for our ads and how much user traffic and so forth? We've decided not to give that information out, and so we don't, and that's why they're upset. And we make them sort of figure it out on their own. And we don't give it out for two reasons. One is that we don't want our competitors to learn it because we've invented models that they don't have, which is what is one of the things that's driving things so quickly from a revenue perspective. And the second is that we use a very complicated formula. And so if I told you you took the click bid times the number of traffic, which is what many people think it should be, you wouldn't get the right answer. So we would, in fact, be misleading people, which is not a good thing. Let's see, in the way back.
I mean, as Google has grown, it's become kind of important, like socioculturally and politically, also with Google News Media. So I'm wondering if there's a strategy within the company for that, and if that differs from country to country to market to market.
With respect to what?
With your positioning as like a cultural and maybe even political phenomenon.
We don't focus on that. There's been debate that we should, but Google is a viral product. It's sort of tribal in the sense that people are part of it, and it evolves. And in almost every case, that has produced a better outcome than planning what would happen. When we go to another country, we ship them a whole bunch of lava lamps. We find that that is a good way to get it started. And if they get big enough, we hire a chef and all that kind of stuff. But there is no strategy, and maybe there should be, and it seems to be working just fine. There's a question here. Go ahead, yes, sir.
So you mentioned briefly organizing the photographs and video. Where do you want to go next in that area?
Well, I would like somebody to invent a way to search non-annotated video text. I know there's some people here who are working on this area. I'd like somebody to figure out a way to do automatic audio to text translation that has higher reliability than the current ones so that we could do automatically search that. The basic problem with multimedia search is that you need some kind of textual annotation in order to do search, and otherwise your hit rates are just terrible. So that's, I think, the search issue that has to get worked on. From an end-user perspective, there are actually very large legal problems with respect to access to copyright holders. I've learned since I've gotten in this job that we think of Hollywood as the movie stars and the producers, but that's not what it really is. Those are the people who work for the people who are lawyers who negotiate incredibly complicated intellectual property agreements. And the recording industry, with respect to music industry, is nothing compared to the movie industry and the video rights industries in terms of their sophistication. And every single contract product structure is different. And so navigating through that maze And, you know, for, as computer scientists, we would say, well, just give us a program, we'll write a set of constraints, and we'll figure it all out. You get paid this, you get paid that. But it's designed to be complicated. And that's, in fact, been the biggest problem we have, which is not a computer problem. It's literally a legal problem. And we're working on that. There's a question way in the back.
There's been an interesting study with Boston with regard to spin-outs from corporations. And, for example, comparing HP with Raytheon. And it turns out that HP spins out a lot more companies than Raytheon does. But it occurs to me, listening to you, that maybe that Raytheon does a better job of capturing innovation and keeping it in-house. Do you plan to keep track of your spin-outs and analyze them as they go along?
Well, we've only done spin-ins. So we have zero data points on spin-outs. And I don't know that the company is going to be running. We run the company in an integrated strategy fashion. So we don't have plans. We're not organized the way these large, historically organized companies are with, you know, we have this division, we get tired of it, we'll get rid of it, we'll buy this other division and run it as a separate P&L. It's an interesting question, but we just don't operate that way. Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Could you comment on tags and social bookmarks?
In what context?
Delicious, Clicker. Are you following that?
It's interesting. I think that there are many people experimenting with ways of taking video and audio and building networks around them. Last year's big excitement was Friendster. Everybody remembers that. I'm not sure that that's so exciting now, but it was you know, very interesting way. We have a product called Orkut, O-R-K-U-T, which is both the product and the man. And Orkut is another very, very successful such site. It's obvious that we could begin to integrate those communities and social networking communities with kind of tagged and personal data in ways that would be predictive. And there's a lot of interesting implications for that if we could figure out how to do it at scale. So let's go. Ed, you want to go ahead?
How do you decide when to try and generate revenue off a new offer? For example, Orkut's been around for probably 2 years now, and I still don't think there are any ads on it.
That's correct.
So you've obviously made a decision not to try and monetize that.
You would assume that the company is more tightly managed than it is. In fact, the Orkut team is so consumed with load from all of its users that it has not had time to think about this question. A better example is Google News, where every month or two we have this conversation. Google News is a very successful product for us, easily monetizable, make lots of money. And they come in and they say, well, do you want more revenue or do you want Arabic news? Well, that seems like a no-brainer. So we do Arabic news. So next month it's going to be, do you want Afghani news? We'll go, well, okay, we'll do Afghani news. You know, only about 300 countries. Right. So, I mean, eventually we'll run out of, you know, this, and then we'll work on monetization. But it's the decisions are not made in a central way. They're made by the teams. Yes, sir.
So Google is still a pretty small company, and I've heard that your guys' management structure is pretty shallow. Like, you have the upper management, and then you have the sort of the middle management, and then you have the developers.
So we try to have as little middle management as possible. They get in the way.
Yeah, but you guys have also been growing at an exponential rate. You've been roughly doubling every year. So how do you plan to keep up? How do you plan to keep up sort of the same work environment as the company's growing?
Well, we like these little groups. And we think that if our model, which is that you define the groups, you find the group structures of small groups, you encourage people into the 70-20-10, and then you do a call for action. You say, these are the areas that we think are interesting. Would you guys self-assemble? And we like that management model. It works for a lot of very senior people. There are people for whom it does not work. They actually want to be managed. They're young enough or inexperienced enough, or they're having their own problems, or they want somebody they can talk to. And so you can't do it without any management, so you have to find some balance. And so we're indeed trying to recruit managers who want to manage but don't want to actually manage too much. In other words, they want to be with people, they like people, they understand how to manage creative people, but they're not going to tell them what to do unless they need to be told. Often, most of you are sort of too young to have seen this, but in the classic engineering company structure is very hierarchical. And everybody's organizing these little, you know, sort of inverse tree structures. And it's just a disaster. It was how I was trained. Right? So,
it seems like information standards are really important to the Google's business, you know, whether it's HTML or data processing and whatnot. As you move into more markets in the future, what do you see your role in shaping
both the standards from both the technological standpoint and the business standpoint?
We have not had to do much there, and I can see us having to do more in the future. We're large enough that what we do is likely to set a standard anyway, and we've always taken the position that the standards should not be proprietary. In other words, they should be open. Because remember, the goal here is all the world's information. And if we can get it all out there, if we can suck it in, we think we have competitive advantages from our data centers, our ad model, our Salesforce, our management culture, and so forth, to take advantage of it. So a traditional company would say, well, here's a standard, it's proprietary, you can't use it. We do the inverse. But there hasn't been so much. It's an interesting idea. We also face the same issue with APIs. Google is not a company that really understands how to promote platform APIs. We have a few. Of course, that's my own technical background. And I've always felt that Google should be better at it because it would be strategic for us. And we're working on that, too. Yes, sir.
Traditionally, in the past, when brand new resources have been invented, like steel or trains or airplanes, it's had huge impacts on people throughout the world. Having all the world's information accessible and searchable is going to be one of those. What do you see over the next 5 years as being some of the key ways people's lives are going to change, the key kind of things people are going to want to do with this information that they can't quite yet do?
The question is, what is the impact, for those who didn't hear, what is the impact of all the world's information over the next 5 years, when if it actually happens? We don't know. With Google Maps, they managed to expose an API that nobody was paying attention to. And then a whole bunch of these online services started taking their data, which was geo-specific, and overlaying it on a map. The best one is that it shows you the live location of the taxi cabs in your city as they're moving around, because the taxi cab people all have a feed of the GPS locations of the taxi cabs. Now, would I have ever thought about that? Not a chance. Right? It happened because somebody exposed an API. We were open to get that information. That's a simple example. I personally believe that the right model is to think of all the world's information in the equivalent of an iPod. So what happens when all of that information is physically, you're carrying it with you? And assume for purposes of argument that there's a real-time update and it's relatively current and there's some way of addressing it. And if this isn't in 5 years, it's probably 10 years. What does it do to teaching when every student basically can do the answer quicker than the professor can get it out of his or her mouth? I don't really know. I mean, when I was growing up in Virginia, I literally had to memorize the names of all the counties. Right? Why do I have to know that? As an executive, I said, of course, we use Google all the time at Google. People will say things, well, I'm not sure if that's really true. You know, a politician came up to me and said, in the typical sonorous voice, did you know that there are more outhouses than TiVos? I said, that can't be true. So what is the query, right? More outhouses than TiVos into Google. So that it was true. The growth rate of outhouses is there's roughly 600,000 of them, and it's minus 0.5% per year. And TiVos, of course, have since grown quite dramatically. I mean, is that fact particularly useful to know? I found it quite interesting. The human mind is a precious thing to waste on this kind of information. In the way back. Yes.
I wasn't familiar with this concept of sort of self-assembling work groups and the call to action. It's very intriguing, but I wonder if it happens that your more senior employees end up sort of getting the most juicy assignments because they have this sort of peer relationship that says, well, they get to do all the interesting things. Does that happen? If it does, how do you combat it, or do you decide not to combat it?
It may happen. It's an interesting question. Programming ability is seems to be uncorrelated with age or rank or seniority. It seems to be a gift. And so I have not seen what you just described happen. What I've seen is that somebody who is just an amazing producer of new and interesting things just becomes a natural leader. And they get to decide. And often they're very young. Often they're perfectly happy to sit in their office working with their friends and eat in the cafeteria. It has not been a problem so far. Yes, sir, next to him.
So one of the things from a user perspective about Google that was really nice for folks was the simplicity of the search interface. And over time, as you add all these new properties, it seems like a large problem is to figure out how you expose those properties to people without making your home page into something like Yahoo that has, you know, hundreds of links all over it. So I'm wondering how you figure out a direction to solve that problem, because, you know, I'm sure if you know in your business, as a web-based service, there's not a lot of lock-in in terms of users sticking with you if something else comes out, like A9, that seems to work well for you.
Well, two different things. First, our business has relatively little lock-in, and that's important because it means that our competitiveness is search by search, person by person, and we understand that, and we talk about that a lot. We have to be better on every search, in every language, everywhere in the world, right now, this 0.1 second. With respect to the home page, the current take is to not change the home page very much, but to try to add these other services either on an exceptional basis, in other words, if you ask for them, or to intuit it, either your pattern or something about you. So we are distinctly trying to not do the Yahoo maneuver, but we have not yet exactly figured out how to solve the problem that you pose. But I agree with your premise. I think it's certainly right. Yes, over here. We'll come over here.
So you just mentioned intuiting the features to add, and you can see when you come up with specific searches these days, the little piece of information appears at the top, like the local or the airline flight tracker, the airport information and whatnot. But there's, as far as I know, that's all done by some Google engineer who writes that pattern that matches that query and then puts that information there.
Yeah.
Are there plans to, say, open search style, make that more?
It may be that this RSS scribble is the first part of that. We're going to experiment with that for a while. What the technology you refer to is internally known as a one box, and it's a set of, what happens with your query is it comes in, and then a whole bunch of computers handle the query itself, and then there's another set of computers that analyze the question of, is this something for a one box? Remember, everything has to be done in 20th of a second or 50th of a second, very, very quickly. And the problem with allowing people who are not in our data centers to produce those results is they can't meet our timing constraints. And Google is designed for speed. Right, so we care about speed for numerous reasons. For example, much of our traffic originates in one continent and serves another continent. So we are one of the biggest beneficiaries of all the dark fiber underneath the oceans. So far we've not been able to do that. It's more likely to be done on a per-person basis than on a generic nation. If it's on a per-person basis, then we can have a smaller number of users for that specialized service, and then it'll go through our data centers into the other folks'. Over here, yes, sir.
As a follow-on kind of to his question, but as you become, let's say you become extremely successful and you do are kind of a gatekeeper to the world's information, it seems like you then become a target for potential government regulation, political interests, certainly in countries that are not as open as the United States. Is that something that you guys are, I know you're somewhat dealing with it with China and other countries?
It's a problem to worry about because we're a big enough force now that people pay a lot of attention to us. And we are creating some negative waves for some people who are disenfranchised or unhappy or don't want this kind of access for one reason or another. The official answer from a company perspective is that we have to follow the law in the country. And if we don't like the law, that doesn't mean that we can just evade it in country A or B or C. So we are forced to, whether we like it or not, and you can have personal opinions that disagree, we have to follow the laws in those countries. Now, in some cases, the laws are, there are ways to work around them in a legal sense of working around them, and of course, we try to do our best. And I think it's going to get worse, you know, as we become more and more of the fabric of online experiences. Yes, sir?
Two more questions, and then there's a reception.
Sure.
All right. So with such a wealth of information that you're trying to, I guess, aggregate and make available, do you see any sort of associated responsibilities with, I don't know, the veracity of the information? So you talked about checking whether there were more TiVos or outhouses, but trusting the results might actually play some role. So, for example, people could put up phony videos or phony websites. Do you see any associated responsibilities with
that? Well, we certainly do. And we define quality as getting the right answer, and we believe that the page rank and all the subsequent algorithms that we use do, in fact, in the vast majority of cases, produced the correct answer. I was interested in the question of how long would I live? Reasonable question. So I said, how long do men live? And the answer came back, an age calculator. So I typed my age in, and I didn't like the answer. So I used a different one. Came up with the same answer. So then I fiddled with the parameters for a while, and I came up with a much better answer. Felt much better. Now, what is it, I mean, how does the computer know which age calculator to use? Well, because of the algorithms that we use, which are related to ranking, link analysis, and so forth that you know about. There are ways that this can not work. For example, Google doesn't really know truth. It just knows what most people think is truth. So if 99% of the people of the world thought that Earth was flat, we would give you that as the answer, even if in fact it were round, or vice versa. So there's a limit to knowledge. And it may be possible over time to get better cognition into the system, and we're certainly working on some AI projects there. But I think ultimately Google is only an expression of the veracity of the information put in it. And this lady here, would you like the last question?
Actually, it's the same question about censorship.
We'll go over here.
Many companies have models for making money using content for the internet, and foreign companies have certainly done well with that in some other situations. But for example, the New York Times is starting to charge. They've announced that starting in the fall, they're going to start to charge for certain types of editorial op-ed type of content.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Just
we know, we know that.
Yeah,
the people who deal with this. Okay, thank you for.
So
perhaps we should talk in the car. Thank you for letting me know.
So the general question then is: in a world where companies realize that they actually have a chance to make money for content, does Google then become middleman for that content and be involved in the charging, or does it keep the model of essentially the free access to information?
A very good question. We're going to do a combination of what you just said. We have built and are in the process of building what we call proprietary content distribution, and the vast majority of the money goes to the content provider, but we keep a fee for providing the billing relationship and so forth. That's a classic distribution deal. That's not going to be the majority of it. The majority of it is going to be sending free traffic to the New York Times, for this case, and then they're going to do upselling. Because the thing that Google can do is we can send so much traffic to these people that they're willing to just let us send traffic to this and give us things that are attractive to get the traffic. And they won't make us pay for it. But they have a legitimate need, an obvious one, to make money. So they can then take that traffic and say, hey, look, here's a way to... the Wall Street Journal is an example, paid service, but you'll see it now in Google News, right? You'll see... You won't see the whole newspaper, but you'll see enough to get your appetite whetted and then upsell. So we don't really know what the structure of the Internet will look like, but Google is likely to be, if not the one of the largest places that people come from the standpoint of being an information publisher, and you'll want to work with us. And by the way, we wouldn't want to do it exclusively. You'll want to work with some other people as well. But we would hope that we would be the largest traffic generator to you as a publisher. And we think that that's good. And one final thing is that we built a product called AdSense for Content, where if you are, in fact, a publisher of information, and let's say that you're the website operator and the author of a site on, a particular brand of golf or something, and there are specialists who care a lot about golf and they all come to this, well, you can make enough money to run your website by simply running some of our ads. And that has turned out to be a huge business for us, much to our surprise. So we are, in fact, trying to make the money move toward the publishers because we need them to make the Internet work.
That was a 20% project by Jeff Dean, if I remember right, actually.
It actually was. Thank you. And thank you for spending so much time with us. Thank you for inviting me. Right? And I will see you again.
Thank you so much.